My name is Kara Ginger and your host of the Biteable podcast, Know Better, Live Best. Today's guest is Dr. Terry Walls, a clinical professor at the University of Iowa, where she conducts clinical trials testing the efficacy of the therapeutic lifestyle to treat multiple sclerosis-related symptoms. In addition, she is the author of The Walls Protocol, How I Beat Progressive MS Using Paleo Principles and Functional Medicine, and the cookbook, The Walls Protocol Cooking for Life, the revolutionary modern paleo plan to treat all chronic autoimmune conditions. Listen as Dr. Terry Walls shares how she changed her diet and lifestyle to restore her health. Know Better, Live Best is dedicated to supporting food and health literacy in people of all ages. Our mission is to cut through the misinformation surrounding food, health, and nutrition because we believe that when people know better, they can make the right choices and live their best lives. We are presented by Biteable Foods. They use blockchain and Internet of Things technology to build traceable, transparent food systems because it shouldn't take an investigative journalist to find out where food comes from. Hello, I am here with Dr. Terry Walls. Hi, doctor, how are you?
Hey, excellent. Thank you for having me.
Well, I really appreciate you coming on tonight. I know everyone's schedules are busy and I know you can attest to that. So I appreciate you taking the time to come on here.
Yes, yes.
So I have to say, I admire you for all of the work that you have done. And I have listened to you a ton, whether it's TED Talks or podcasts, and we'll get to some of your books later, but those are on my April and May reading list of things that are going to help me. But go ahead and give us and the listeners a little bit about your background.
Sure. I'm an academic internal medicine physician, which means I'm here at the University of Iowa. I've taught medical students. I teach residents. I was really a very traditional internal medicine physician, believed completely in the latest science, drugs, technology, was very skeptical of special diets, complementary alternative medicine. But God works in mysterious ways. In 2000, I was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis on the basis of a history of dim vision 13 years earlier, a new problem with my left leg, an abnormal MRI of my spinal cord and my brain, showing lesions of my spinal cord and abnormal spinal fluid. I knew I wanted to treat my disease aggressively because within 10 years, people with MS, half will be unable to work due to severe fatigue, and a third will have gait disability, needing a cane, walker, or wheelchair. So I did some searching, found that the best MS research center was the Cleveland Clinic, so I went there, saw their best people, took the newest drugs. And over the next 3 years, I had one episode of weakness involving my right hand. So if I'd been in a drug trial, that would be a huge success. But the problem was I was getting steadily weaker. My Cleveland Clinic physicians told me about the work of Loren Cordain. I read his papers, read his books, and decided that his advocacy of the paleo diet made sense. And so after a lot of prayer and meditation, and after being 20 years as a vegetarian, I went back to eating meat. Gave up all grain, all legumes, all dairy. The next year, I needed a tilt-recline wheelchair. I took mitoxantrone, a form of chemotherapy. I continued to decline. And then I took Tysabri, that very new potent biologic drug, and I continued to decline. And then I was placed on Cellcept, and I continued to decline. So it was apparent to me that despite taking the best drugs from the best people at one of the best MS centers in the world, I was continuing to decline. And I was unlikely to stop my slide into a bedridden, potentially demented life. I also have trigeminal neuralgia, which is part of MS, sort of episodes of extremely painful electrical face pain that was coming more frequently, more difficult to control. And so I decided to do everything that I possibly could to slow my decline, because I knew once you had progressive MS, there were no more spontaneous recoveries. The question was just how fast were you going to go downhill. I'm reading the animal models for MS, for Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, ALS, Huntington's disease, decide that mitochondria are key in all of these things, and begin, again, researching and making a vitamin and supplement cocktail for my mitochondria, which does appear to slow my decline, although I'm not recovering, but I'm very grateful that my decline is slowing somewhat. The university and the VA redesigned my job multiple times. I Volunteered to be on the Institutional Review Board, reviewing clinical research studies, and I'm staffing residents in their clinic. By the summer of 07, I'm so weak I can no longer sit up in a regular chair like you and I are now. I have a zero-gravity chair, one at home, one at work, where I can recline with my knees higher than my nose. I can walk short distances using two walking sticks. I'm beginning to have, I have severe fatigue. I'm really quite fatigued by 10 in the morning. I'm beginning to have problems with brain fog. And my trigeminal neuralgia is more frequently on and difficult, very difficult to get turned off. Life is not good. That summer in July, my chief of staff calls me in to tell me that he's assigning me effective January in about 6 months to the traumatic brain injury clinic, where I'll be part of a multidisciplinary team. I'll be having to examine veterans, provide primary care to them, and there will be no residents. So I realize this is a job that physically it's very unlikely that I can do. And it's probably, you know, my boss's way of saying, you're gonna have to take medical retirement. And, you know, if I am beginning to have brain fog, it's, you know, I'm not criticizing him. It was a reasonable strategy. Mm-hmm. But as I said, God works in mysterious ways. It was that summer that I discovered the Institute for Functional Medicine. I took their course on neuroprotection, had a longer list of vitamins and supplements, and a little deeper understanding of things I could do to support my mitochondria. And then later in the fall, I have another big aha moment, like, you know, what if I redesign my paleo diet to maximize the intake of these nutrients that I was taking in pill form? I'd stay on the supplements, but I was going to reshape my paleo diet in a very specific way. So that was more research to get that figured out. But by, you know, the end of December, I had redesigned my paleo diet. And then, you know, January comes along, and I have to go to the traumatic brain injury clinic, and the first week, I just watch what everyone does. Well, I should be able to watch. That should be too hard. Then the next week, I'm, you know, seeing some patients. And I'm getting up, doing the exams. And at the end of the week, I'm like, well, that wasn't too bad. Then the next week, we do it again. And I'm like, you know, I think my energy is improving. And my mental clarity is improving. And then at the end of 3 months, I decide to begin walking with a cane around the hospital. And at the end of six, and I hadn't done that, you know, for years. And at the end of 6 months, I'm walking around the hospital without a cane. At the end of 9 months, and I should say, you know, whenever most of us who have a progressive neurodegenerative disease like MS, as you get more and more disabled, eventually get to a point of acceptance where you let go of life and just take each day as it unfolds, and there's a certain level of peace. So here I am getting remarkably better, but remember, I had already given up on my expectations. I was just taking every day, one day at a time, and I had no idea what this meant. But it was a Mother's Day in 2008. I convinced my family to let me do a bike ride around the block. My son jogged on the left, my daughter jogged on the right, my wife followed in her bike. And I bike around the block, you know, I'm crying, my kids are crying, Jackie's crying. And if you looked at me closely, you'd see that I'm crying now because I can't talk about this moment without getting emotional, because that was when I understood that the current understanding of multiple sclerosis, progressive MS, is incomplete. That recovery is possible, at least a remarkable level of function can return, even in those who are severely disabled, if we provide the correct environment. And what I'd done was I really attended, again, using science to design a diet and lifestyle that was as optimally designed for health and for cellular function that I could. And I'd done all of that not to recover, because I knew recovery was not possible. I'd done all of that to slow my decline. And it wasn't until I was able to bike around the block, like, well, how much recovery might be possible? And then at 12 months, I do what was unthinkable. I'm able to do an 18.5 bicycle ride with my family. And this, of course, really changes how I think about disease and health. It would change the way I practice medicine. I spend more and more time in my primary care clinic and in the traumatic brain injury clinic talking to my patients about diet quality, about sleep, about stress, about their physical activity levels, and teaching them about how powerful therapeutic diet and lifestyle can be. So I transformed my clinical practice. And then ultimately, my chief of medicine would call me in and give me the job of writing up a case report, writing up a case series, and then saying, well, this is so important, Terry, I need you to shift to your research focus, and this is the research area that you're going to focus on. And he found me the correct mentors and helped me launch this new area of research.
I think it's amazing. And you've been touched on it a bit, because I was thinking as you were telling your very inspiring story, is I would feel that, and what you said, hope would almost be lost during that time.
Well, as I was getting more and more disabled, I have to reimagine my life and my role. I have two kids. At the time of diagnosis, my son was 8, my daughter was 5. And, before becoming a physician, I was a competitive athlete. I competed nationally in full contact taekwondo. And did wilderness traveling, long distance running and skiing. And so I'd assumed I'd teach my kids resilience and resolve and perseverance through athletic endeavors. And of course, that was not going to get to happen. So I would have to reimagine my role as a parent, as a spouse, as a physician, as my physical capabilities changed. And that, of course, was profoundly challenging. Mm-hmm.
I just think the drive you have is almost unthinkable, because I imagine things like that when I hear stories, and especially a mother of young children, that just really tugs at my heartstrings, as I have 3 young ones myself, and you want to live for them. And the work you do is really also for them and you, to create a better life for them and to see their strong mother.
So one of the books that I really loved was Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning. And one of his concepts that he talks about is between every event in your life and your response to that is a space, and that space you make a choice. So I thought a lot about the most important thing I wanted for my kids was for them to be successful emotionally and economically successful as adults, which meant they would have to be willing to deal with all the terrible things that happen in life, because life is full of great moments and difficult ones. And so they're going to watch me. And if I gave up just because life was difficult, I was teaching them that when life is difficult, you give up. Or I can just go forward and admit life's not fair, but so what? You go to work, you do the best you can anyway. And they had chores and they complained bitterly. I said, yep, it's so unfair that you have these terrible chores and this terrible life, but that's how it is. Those are your chores. It's not fair. I have MS, but that's how it is, and I have to go to work. And yes, life is difficult. And both of my kids, at about the same age, would stamp their feet and say, I think you're glad you have MS so you can lecture me about life. And I'd say, well, we just got to make the best of it. Whatever our circumstances, we've got to make the best of it.
You do, and you have to use that time to teach that. Like I said, you had these dreams of how you were going to teach persistence and maybe that grit and things that you need, to succeed in life. And you did. It just was not in the way that you had envisioned.
I've learned another really wonderful wise saying is that we spend a lot of time mourning for the life that we had planned for. But when we finally embrace the life that we have been given, that's when we can learn and grow and do transformational work. And it was so I spent a fair amount of time mourning the life that I had planned, which, this athletic, fun, academic kind of person. And then when I finally embraced, okay, this is the life I've got, I got to make the best of it, I was teaching my kids a lot of resilience. And both kids talk about what they learned by watching me get up and do. Again, I'm going to be tearful here.
Yeah.
The workouts I did every single day when they would get up to be going off to swim or off to school and theater, I was doing my physical therapy workout every day, lifting weights, doing mats, swimming. Not a big workout, but I knew if I did any more than that, I couldn't function. So they saw the commitment that I had to doing everything that I could. And they talk about that now. And for a while, as I recovered, I was telling, and I tell the world that, I'm actually very grateful for having been so disabled, because I would not have been willing to relearn and rethink my approach to disease and health without all of that disability. So I'm actually quite grateful for those times. And it's taken my kids a long time to let go of the sadness that they had over it. Life was tough. It was tough for them. It was tough for me. And now they too are finally beginning to say that, yes, they got a tremendous learning from having gone through all of that.
Oh, experiences really shape you. As a teacher myself, just that growth mindset and to not give up and just teaching them real life values of life happens.
Life happens.
What are you going
to do? We get to have some great times, mm-hmm. but we also have some very difficult times. And, you know, and frankly, if we don't experience both, we don't realize that those good times are good.
You're absolutely right. It makes you more appreciative. Mm-hmm. I have many instances of that in my life, of times where it's very easy to get down just through the stresses of life. And it's just turning yourself around. Just, nope.
We have to remember that life is ups and downs. The events are simply events. It's the meanings we apply to them that determine, are the events going to crush us or will we still go forward?
And, so, and you went forward. I mean, what you found through your trials and your research of just creating, or what you thought, just maybe just to stop, or not to stop, for me,
just to slow.
To slow down. Correct. The decline, unfortunately, of what you had accepted, like you said. And certain things started happening through your research. So, and part of that is environment, genetics, that can all go into MS. So can you talk a little bit about environment and maybe
sure.
first?
So if you look at it, we have more and more autoimmune diseases. We probably have about 25 million people with autoimmune diseases, another 50 million that have autoantibodies. So there's evidence our bodies are attacking ourselves and beginning to cause damage. So this is a common, common phenomenon. And we're also beginning to understand the genetics here. For any autoimmune diagnosis, it looks like there's between 200 and 300 genes that will increase your risk ever so slightly. And so it might be 1%, 0.5% for each gene. The vast majority of people with that particular gene will not get MS or will not get inflammatory bowel disease. So it appears to be a very complicated interaction between the genes I got from mom and dad. So I still get to blame them a little bit. And then my lifetime of food choices, toxin exposures, hormone balance, cortisol levels, vitamin D levels, chemicals to which I've been exposed, the atrazine, lead, mercury, arsenic, the microbes to which I've been infected or do not have, that have disappeared from my gut, because I appreciate that the microbiome is so important, and whether or not I developed a leaky gut and abnormal immune response to some of the food proteins that I eat. So it's all of those factors. And I can't change the genes that I got from mom and dad. I can change the gene expression by turning genes on and off through dietary choices, through amount of sleep that I get, physical activity levels. And I can change the microbiome. Which we also are beginning to learn has a huge, every year we're learning that its impact on our health is far larger than we realized. So there are many, many things that we can do that can shift our probability of improving health or our probability of declining health and worsening disease burden. And it's diet and lifestyle.
See, and this gets really, this really just hits home for me. As the listeners know, I really took to health and food, and food as medicine, just from inflammation in my body, just achy knees, many issues with back. I ended up having back surgery. Just too many to count, just from, I truly think, the food I am intaking for the last, you know, 30 plus years. And so to hear you speak about everything you've done, I think should give many listeners just hope.
Oh, I, you know, absolutely. And, you know, I, in one sense, I'm the canary in the coal mine. I'm blessed that my genetics were such and my environmental exposures were such that I had developed severe dysfunction, severe symptoms, a profound disability at a very young age, and then had the fortunate ability to read all the science, assimilate it, and begin to just step by step addressing diet and environmental factors as well as I could. And like a true mom, I was doing this because I wanted to not become a financial burden on my family. So I wanted to slow the decline so I could continue to work a little bit longer. And the small amount of walking I was doing, you know, was a huge on the quality of life and being able to, you know, feed yourself. So as you get more and more disabled, these little tiny functional factors become increasingly important. Very, you know, very meticulous, very science-based. They always chose interventions that had lots of research behind them. And then, you know, the unthinkable happened. You know, my thinking, Claire, you know, greatly improved. My energy greatly improved. My horrific face pains faded away. It, you know, I get stronger. I can walk again. And then as I'm traveling around, and I start going to scientific meetings and doing presentations, and I can't quite follow the walls diet as well on the road, my brain fog comes back. And like, okay. Or if I accidentally get exposed to gluten, dairy, or eggs, my electrical face pain turns on 6 to 24 hours to incapacitating levels of pain. So, you know, it's brutally clear that for me, dietary triggers can suddenly dial up the pain to horrific levels, which I now, you know, for years, that pain was so difficult to deal with. Now I see that pain as a profound gift because it's a barometer that lets me know how is my environment. If I'm beginning to feel any of my facial zingers, you know, I sit down, I check in with my family, and we think very deeply about what were the environmental exposures, what's going wrong in my therapeutic diet and lifestyle that I have to tune up. And so far, we've always been able to find exposures that were likely the trigger that I could turn up. So now I really have come to see my symptoms as this very nice rheostat on what is the level of inflammation in my brain, how is my cellular functioning. And I'm either feeling great or I'm not quite feeling great, and I'd better be paying attention to doing a better job taking care of myself.
Has there been anything that's really surprised you? I'm just thinking, I'm sure you've, I'm
oh, guessing sure.
you've gotten the food down.
So we got the food down, and you know, I've learned to be very meticulous when I'm going out somewhere, making sure I'm talking to the chef so we know how clear that is. But, you know, some other unanticipated issues. Travel. So as I'm lecturing more and going around the world more, I came to realize that flying is a fairly toxic event. You're on elevation, so you have extra radiation as a result of that. And diet quality is a little less reliable. My vegetable intake goes down, so I travel with vegetables. I have a head of cabbage sliced up in my luggage and then in my carry-on, so that's a hoot. And because of the way planes are treated to decrease the risk of transporting vermin, so there's insect. The planes are fumigated, and there's more plastics in the plane, so there's a higher exposure of xenobiotics that my body has to process. On top of that, depending on the air control systems, you could end up with some vaporized exhaust that's come through and jet fuel that's come through in the air cabins. So the indoor air quality in tight buildings actually is more polluted than many people realize, and the indoor air quality in some planes are more challenging. And so I've had to, and I've worked with my own personal physician to refine my detox protocol before travel, during flight, and after travel, so I can accommodate that. And then the other thing I have to sort of monitor is how many miles can I fly in a month and not trigger a flare of my pain. And so what I've come to is I can do two big domestic flights in a month. If I do three, I'm inviting a flare of pain. If I do an international flight, let's say I go to Europe or Australia, of course, you know, that's, I really have to plan for that and detox and manage that very carefully.
The detox, I think it's absolutely fascinating. The foods you have spoke of that can help detox, and are there phases? Is that what there are?
Yeah, there, so there's
maybe one of your books.
Yeah, there's phase one and phase two. Some steps that we go through to get the molecules that are fat soluble to make them water soluble, so you can put them out in your sweat, your bile, your urine. They also go out through your skin and through your lungs to a lesser degree as well. And so you want to be able to support both phases of this, what's called biotransformation of these toxic molecules. The stuff we can't get out will get stored in bones. It'll get stored in fat. If you suddenly lose a lot of weight, you release a lot of toxins. If you break your bones, you'll release some toxins. If you got your mercury fillings drilled out by someone who doesn't know how to do that very, very safely to minimize the release, you could end up releasing a fair amount of toxins. You want to improve detoxification. You have to do it in a very careful way, because if you mobilize the toxins out of your fat in a way that isn't balanced with your phase one, phase two detox, you can get a surge of these toxins into your bloodstream, which then gets distributed up into your brain and back to your fat, and can lead to more problems with brain fog and some neurologic issues.
See, and that was surprising to me. I didn't realize how dangerous that could potentially be to drop maybe a quick amount of weight if you're not detoxifying the correct way.
You want to be very careful about that. And some people go on an aggressive detox protocol. They want to do chelation. And there are circumstances where chelation is life-saving, particularly for an acute poisoning. For chronic poisoning, you have to be very, very careful about chelation, because the risk is if you get the pace incorrect, you can damage your liver, your kidney, your brain. And you know, all three of those organ systems are very, very important. So I'm much more comfortable with for a chronic exposure, a slower detox. For acute poisoning, chelation sometimes is absolutely life-saving.
Okay, and so brain fog, that's interesting to me. I've worried so much about inflammation in my body, but I'm thinking more joints and my back and areas like that. But brain fog, I've almost, this is dawning on me, I have brain fog, but I always thought it was just me. And I'm more on a recent journey the past year and a half, but I'm still researching. I don't have this down yet.
So brain fog is simply your brain telling you that it's not able to do the work of the brain cells optimally. So your recall's not quite as good, your working memory's not quite as good, your problem solving is not quite as good, your verbal and spatial reasoning is not quite as good. And, you know, if we did neuropsychological testing on you, your peak performance in the world right now is around age 12 to 18. So our kids are right, and they say it's all downhill after that. If we take great care of ourselves in terms of food, diet, exercise, we can maintain that great brain. Then we get judgment along with that. So we can have terrific performance into our 90s and 100. But most of us aren't taking care of ourselves nutritionally or with diet or lifestyle. And so we experience this steady decline in terms of brain function and physical function. That should not happen. Should not happen. If we are feeding and nourishing our brain with the proper nutrition, with the proper hormonal balance and sunlight, with physical activity, with social connections, with life's meaning and purpose, your brain should be functioning very well. You should have good working memory, good spatial memory, good verbal memory. And if you aren't, it's your brain trying to tell you, please tune up my environment. Please tune up my environment, reduce the inflammation in my brain, reduce the oxidative stress, and give my brain more of the building blocks that it needs.
See, my body is talking to me, and I thought I was listening.
You were listening, but now you're listening at a more deep level.
I am, and that's where I feel like there's so much more I don't know through this information on this journey I'm on. And that's why I appreciate talking to you, because you've written books of Food as Medicine and what you were just talking about a bit, the Wallace Protocol, Cooking for Life, about the, you know, yes, phases. And you even have, I mean, there's options for vegans or vegetarians.
Yes.
Also,
you know, I'm very mindful that vegetarians and vegans may be making that choice for deeply held spiritual beliefs. And I'm very open to supporting that. I just want to give them guidance on how to do that safely so they can have the healthiest, more vital brain and still honor their deeply held spiritual beliefs. And then I want my meat eaters to realize that it's, while you can be healthy eating only meat, there are trade-offs with that. And since most of our societies that do that eat only raw meat, and that's it's a different kind of animal than what most of us are eating now. So I want them to understand the nuances if they want to be meat eaters. And those who want to be ketogenic eaters, there's great research actually used to grow about the benefits of a ketogenic diet. And I want them to be mindful of the potential downsides of a ketogenic diet, so to get guide how to optimize that. And then we talk a bit about the elimination diet. And who might need a more restrictive diet and under what circumstances. You know, another thing, because I do dietary intervention studies and I work very closely with dietitians, we also did, and of course my dietitians are very emphatic. They want to know that the diets that I'm talking about and the rules that I'm creating for people create diets that are nutritionally sound, that we're providing the vitamins, minerals, antioxidants, fats, proteins that our bodies need to work. So we made menus, we made recipes, and we tested our rules for each level. And I published all that data in the Walls Protocol. And of all the people who are writing diet books, I'm the only one that has done that. And of course, and part of the reason is that it's expensive. It's very expensive to do what I did. But because I do dietary research, I'm aware of that. And I could have that completed. So we could say that here are the rules, here's why we've done that that way, and we've analyzed the data to show you that it's nutritionally sound.
So maybe people out there with MS, or maybe they're just trying to come up with a plan and they're meeting with their doctors, do you have any advice outside of that that they could follow?
Oh, yeah. So the first one is go to my website, terrywalls.com/diet, and we have a one-page handout that is a really lovely summary to get you going. And at the high level, I'm suggesting you go remove the most inflammatory foods out of your diet, sugar, gluten, and dairy in particular. I'd also remove eggs as well, because eggs can be a common unrecognized food sensitivity. And then we ramp up the vegetables. And then we have different guidance if you're a meat eater or if you're not a meat eater. And if you want more details about the other lifestyle things, and there are many additional things that I would have you do, we go over that in exquisite detail in my books.
And I have been on your page quite a bit and have listened to you, anything I could find on the internet. It was just fascinating to me, especially with food. And this is your body, right, that you're treating. And it's not just maybe people that have autoimmune diseases or, you know, MS specifically with what you're treating, but just to have a healthy life, like you said, to live into your 90s with mental clarity.
We should all care much more about our health span than our lifespan. I'm interested in walking, hiking, biking, writing books, reading, contributing to my family. And so I want to be able to play with grandchildren, should I ever have the benefits of those, and the great-grands. It's not useful to me, from my point of view, to become demented and live another 20 years. I want to live to be 120, still writing books, still lecturing, still saving the world, having a great time, still biking, still hiking, and I have every reason to expect that I can do that. But I can only do that if I eat for health, if I walk for health, and if I choose to have the most health-promoting lifestyle factors that science is aware of.
And I can only hope that the listeners right now are hearing this and want to look more into it, because I think so often, in my case and in yours, some life event happens or something happens that maybe leads you to looking into food. And maybe not just popping the next pill, which obviously can be easy to do because we're looking for something that can help us.
Well, and we're so addicted to sugar, you know, and the processed food has been designed very specifically by food scientists to create products that light up our brain with our pleasure centers to drive us to overconsume. And when we overconsume those products, that makes for a lot of profit for those food companies. But in the process, it makes me more likely to be obese, makes me more likely to have insulin resistance. It makes me more likely to have excessive oxidative stress in my cells, excessive inflammation, and worsening health. And instead, you know, I would tell people, eat vegetables, learn how to cook at home. And then we have to talk about, you know, the meat or protein, you know, decisions you're going to make about that. But cooking at home together as a family, not from boxes, but from ingredients, is a profound act to reclaim your life and your health and the health of everyone in your family.
Oh, absolutely. And I think with the vegetables, and you've spoken on this a lot, you recommend just loads of vegetables. And I know there's different.
That's right. No one should be hungry. So the point is, you know, I'm a tall lady, 6 foot tall, so it's 9 cups of vegetables, 3 cups of greens, 3 cups of sulfur-rich in the cabbage, onion, mushroom family, 3 cups of deeply pigmented beets, carrots, berries, and then your protein source. And I like to have plenty of healthy fats, flax oil, hemp oil, olive oil, ghee, lard, bacon fat, chicken fat, schmaltz, but no processed foods. Things that come to you in a box or a can, better to avoid. Now, I have taken care of many people living on food stamps. And so we talk about how to make this real for them. And certainly in my clinics at the VA, the people I took care of were on disability living on food stamps. They were not going to Whole Foods. We taught them how to cook, using ingredients they could get in their local grocery stores across rural Iowa. And sometimes it was frozen food, sometimes it was canned food, sometimes it was stuff they were foraging or out of their garden or the venison that they could hunt. But the key thing is you will have to learn how to cook. And so, you know, we often had cooking classes and we did cooking food demos, showed them how to make green smoothies, how to make cooked greens, how to make soups and stews. And we have vegetarian options to make it more affordable. And we talked about how to get children involved, how to get the whole family doing this, that the family that will eat together and support one another will be vastly more successful at reclaiming the health and vitality of the whole family.
Well, it's so important to get everyone on board. And that's something I still struggle with. My husband's actually on board. I think anything I cooked up, he would eat. He'd just be like, happy yes. I'm cooking. He's like, sure, I'll eat that, whatever you put in front of me. So he's super supportive because he knows it's important to me. And it's certainly not going to hurt him yes. by yes. eating healthy. Yes. It's the children right now.
You know, it's absolutely a challenge in terms of how do we get our kids on board? How do we make this kid friendly? Talking about it, if you have the opportunity to have the children help grow some of the food, help with making the menus, helping with shopping, cooking, doing chores. I think it's vital that our young people, as soon as they can hold anything in their hands, are helping with the tasks of family life. And so you have to have things that are age appropriate that a 3-year-old and a 4-year-old can do, and most children want to be a part of family life. They may sort of fuss a little bit about it, but throughout the reality is if you continue that this is just part of family life, they love being adults. They want to be part of this. And you know, one of the jobs that we have, and this is before I understood that food was going to be so vital in our life, was our children had, beginning in junior high, one of their chores was they had to prepare a meal, one meal a week for the family. And that was their job. We could help them, but we weren't doing it. They could tell us what to do. They could pick out the menu. We'd have to approve it. And so as we figured out how vital food was, their menus took a little shift. But both of my kids are very comfortable cooking and are very comfortable having friends coming over and cooking an easy meal or a lavish feast.
That's a hope for anyone that's struggling with their children and eating yes. and just wanting to help out. Because I really think it's about creating a new normal. They might get stuck in their ways and now they're like, what do you want me to do? It just has to become
new. Create a new normal. It's the family chore, the family experience, the family meals. I would remove from the house. So the approach that many of our families in clinics and my clinical trials, and it depends on your kids. You can sort of decide the foods that will have to be excluded from the household because of mom's health needs or dad's health needs are, if you bring it into the house, too bad, I'm throwing it out. If you're away from the house, you get to eat what you want. But if I'm paying for it, if it's in my house, here are the rules. And for some families, it was in mom or dad's eating space, here are the rules. In your room, I'll let you have different rules. But many families said, if I'm paying for it, here are the rules. The excluded foods, whatever it was that they decided were going to be excluded, were excluded, and the allowed foods were allowed. And they had plenty of foods that tasted good, that were available. And so kids don't have to be hungry. But you don't have foods that are harmful to their brains around for them. And you have to do a lot of talking, mm-hmm. a lot of explanation of why this is, and that kids want to be strong and healthy and vigorous. They want big muscles. Yep. they want fast bodies. They want smart bodies. Although you have to be a little worried about some of our girls want to dumb down, so you have to be a little careful about that. They will listen to the conversation the two parents are having, and they will watch what the parents are eating. Mm-hmm. And so if you have a united front with the parents, you can bring your kids on board. And that, it does get more complicated if you have extended family, aunts and uncles and grandparents, and getting them all on board. And if the child has, it's a little different issue. Is it the parent that has the health challenge you're addressing? Is it the child or the children has the health challenge you're addressing? And another thing that I talk to many families about is if one of the parents has an issue that you're addressing, you need to know that by addressing this as a family, you're protecting the health of that child because that child shares the genes with those parents. And if they have a toxic standard American diet, they're developing the disease state as a child that will manifest as a young adult. But you could stop that. This is the prodrome stage. You could stop all of that by getting the child on board with a healthy diet and lifestyle now.
See, I'm glad you bring that point up because that's what kind of gives me my drive right now of trying to find ways to cook food that my boys will eat. I say my boys because my daughter, she's really to the summer. She has a decent taste palate. She'll try a lot of things, we'll eat it. So I still think I can keep her going. But my boys, and I'm like trying to find ways to cook food because for their health. It's not about what I'm not letting them have and trying to word it in a way that's positive for them. So
yes.
It's like, mom's mean. Mom's not letting me have this or I can't have that.
Well, yeah, I'm working with a pediatrician right now. So a project that we're working on right now, because he is so impressed with the impact of teaching his families to adopt the Walls Protocol. So we're working on developing a Walls Protocol for kids that focuses on making this very kid-friendly. So stay tuned. I'm not quite sure how many months it will take for us to refine this, but you know, I've become much more appreciative of collaborations with pediatricians now. And so I have a few pediatricians that I'm working more closely with. So we'll see. I think this is a very important area. Because as I look at the health challenges affecting our children, these huge rates of obesity, high blood pressure, type 2 diabetes, type 1 diabetes, autoimmunity, mental health problems, rage and violence, learning disabilities, it's not that the genes have changed for these kids, it's that the environment has so dramatically changed. And so if we love our kids, and we do, I mean, we all love our kids. It's the very rare parent that doesn't have that bonding.
Right.
We have to figure out how to help our children have a better environment so we can turn off those disease-promoting genes and turn on the health-promoting ones. That means figuring out how to get your kids fired up about vegetables,
yes.
Which means you and your whole family have to be fired up about vegetables, and how to get fired up about sleeping at night, and social connections, and movement. And usually, we have to do things one at a time. It can be overwhelming if I gave you the whole list of all the behaviors, say, okay, fix them all. Yeah, that's, in general, too big of a task. So we talk about the environmental factors, then I engage in a conversation about trying to understand from their point of view where they would like to focus first. I may have an opinion as to what I think is the most powerful, but it's going to be also up to the family in terms of what are they comfortable embracing next.
And I appreciate how you're wanting to have a conversation and make them part of it and give them some
yes.
choice in the matter.
Absolutely.
It's a positive choice.
It's a choice that you can, and it might be that I can't face this now. And it's like, okay, fine. Come back when you are, when you are ready. Because people have to be, it's a lot of work to do all this stuff. And so people need to be ready to do the work. Having a physical goal in mind can be helpful for some families. You know, here in Iowa, it's doing the annual bike ride across the state, or maybe it is doing the fun run for the school, or maybe it is being in the local children's theater, but some physical task that they'd like to see as a big goal for themselves and the family, that's helpful. And then we can begin to talk about what incremental steps they'd like to make towards that goal.
Oh, absolutely. There are so many important things we need to do for our children and ourselves. Decide where to start, whether technology, food they're eating, just their growth mindset. Lots to do, but you know, we all care about our kids and we're going to keep going.
Moms and dads, we do a lot for our kids.
Yeah.
We will do a lot. And helping moms and dads realize that making these changes, while it might be hard for the kids, it could also be life-saving for their children.
I 100% agree. 100% agree with that. Because I think back to the way I chose to eat. I've been an adult for quite some time, and I'm wishing I could go back and change that. However, I can't. But I'm excited about the future and what I can still do for my body to live that long, healthy life, or at least healthier life than I would have. And I eat loads of vegetables all the time, and you talk about that. But how important is like the quality of sourcing of your food?
Well, you know, I tell people we have to live with whatever your economic reality is.
Yeah.
And so if your economic reality is that you're going to your local Hy-Vee or your local Kroger's, whatever your local grocer is, do the best that you can. Mm-hmm. The really good news is as public demand and interest in organic food has increased and local food has increased, the cost of organics has decreased. And then you have groups like Environmental Working Group that has the Dirty Dozen and the Clean 15, so that can help you prioritize. And many more people are, you know, my vets taught me, you know, some really great strategies. They go to their local farmer's market. So I've got, after they hang out with me for a while, they realize food quality matters. Mm-hmm. So my vets go to the local farmer's market, and they'll go to all the vendors, figure out who's organic, who's not. Then they'll say to the organic guys and ladies, now at the end of the market, if I come by and I offer to buy everything that you've got left that hasn't sold, what's the best price you can give me? So that's brilliant.
That's brilliant.
You know, that's brilliant. So these people are able to get organic vegetables. They can't get organic meats that way, but they can get organic vegetables. Mm-hmm. Pennies on the dollar. By just going to the farmer's market and offering, you know, to buy at the end. The other thing that they've been able to do is to go to these farmers, say, if I come help you harvest. And so they offer their labor to go help prepare the food. And so getting out to the farmers, talking with them, people have developed a relationship. So, you know, it's actually fairly common that in my clinic, the vets come in, they're on disability, they're on food stamps. They start just getting, you know, their canned vegetables from the local grocer. They hear me talk about food quality, do the best that you can. And by the time 6 months has come around, they have figured out how to connect with farmers and get organic vegetables either through just labor themselves or inexpensively at the end of the farmer's market. So many of these folks have gone from eating lots of junk food to within 6 months eating almost entirely organic food. And they're still on food stamps, and their health is remarkably better.
Well, and they're also, by putting in that time and being creative with how they get their organic fruits and vegetables, they're also going to be saving money on hospital costs or medical costs if their health eventually improves.
Yes, so eventually they're getting outside, they're being more active, they're being more socially connected. They're part of a community. They have a little more purpose. It helps in so many ways. If you look at the Blue Zones projects, the communities that have the highest number of folks that live to 100, there are common themes. It's eating meals as a extended family. Elders are prized. Physical activity is prized. Social connection is prized. People are eating vegetables. They might be eating grains or not. They might be eating meat or not. They might have wine in moderation or not. But the common things are community, purpose, valuing your elders, in being physically active.
And I have talked to so many of farmers as well in community. Everyone just keeps coming back to community and getting connected with your local farmers, because you learn so much more about your food and where mm-hmm. it comes from, and it makes you more appreciative of what is on that plate that's in front of you.
You know, so many parents would say, my kids will never eat that. And yet when the child helps grow that food, when the child helps prepare that food, they're surprised that their child likes carrots. They're surprised that the child can enjoy these vegetables. Now, when we took fat away from vegetables, vegetables became bitter, and that's very hard for kids to eat. But if we put fat back on the vegetables, and if they still seem a little bit bitter, add some lime or lemon juice or vinegar, balsamic vinegar, lowers the pH, cuts the bitterness, Then, you know, for my kids, their favorite vegetable are cooked greens.
That you just might be my savior to my children. See, this journey I'm on can be connected everywhere, because it is. Yes. It really can't. I know we keep coming back to it, and it is hard. You care about your kids and the food,
you
and
care about your kids.
I love them. I love vegetables.
We love our kids, and we have to remember the bitter flavors will be more intense for our children, mm-hmm. because they're younger. And the way to lower that bitterness is you decrease the pH by adding acid. And you could use your taste to tell, you know, when it's no longer bitter. And then you also add fat. So you can add bacon fat. You can add ghee. You can add coconut oil. You could add olive oil. Just don't add any margarine or hydrogenated fats. That would be terrible.
Right.
But you could add cold oils afterwards. Or you could have saturated fat if you're going to cook it. So fat and something acid will do go a long, long way to cutting bitterness. My vets loved my recipe for vegetables. And here, and your kids, if you're a meat eater, and it's, you're okay with eating pork, this is the solution to your concerns with your kids.
Okay.
Fry a couple pieces of bacon to the desired level of doneness. Take the bacon out of the pan, chop it up side to side. Leave the fat in the pan, put your vegetables in, cook maybe 2 minutes, or if it's greens, just stir it until they're wilted, and then add the chopped bacon and serve. If it feels a bit bitter, add just a bit of lime juice or balsamic vinegar. If it still seems bitter, double the bacon the next time you make the recipe. My vets have all, to a one, of the folks who eat meat, to the one have come back and said, oh my God, it was delicious. The broccoli was delicious that way. The greens were delicious that way. The Brussels sprouts were delicious that way. I had no idea, Doc. They could be so good. It's when we went low fat that we ramped up the bitterness and made vegetables terrible. So you have to put in the fat. And when we realize that if they're bitter, we just have to lower the pH. And you've got lime or vinegar, and you can lower the pH.
See, and that I did not know, but this, and it sounds so simple, which is always great when, you know, schedules can
get simple after you know.
After, it really is after you know, because you're always, you don't know what to do, and then it seems overwhelming. You're not sure where to start researching.
Correct.
And then you don't, because something else comes up.
You know, we're busy. We have so many demands that you know, and that's just how life is.
Right. My husband will
make it much, so. It'll make it much easier. Get your kids involved. They can sort of help you taste, like, okay, Joey, what do you think? Should I add more lime or not? Should I add more cut up cranberries? Should I add more? And so you could add little chopped bits of fruit into your vegetables to fill a bit of that sweet and sour. That's another nice trick. So Brussels sprouts and cranberries, fabulous combination.
You know, it's kind of funny and eye-opening. I do that when I eat. Why have I not thought about adding the fruits to the vegetables? Because my kids will eat fruit all day long. That part's yes. Easy. It's the vegetables that I struggle with.
So and sort of think about this for the kids. If I have about 2/3 the amount of vegetables and 1/3 the amount of fruit at the end of the day, that's probably a reasonable balance for the child. If the child's obese and you're trying to wean, then you may want to reduce the fruit. We took away the excluded foods. All the carbs off the, you know, breads, pastas, rice, it's all gone. That's vegetables, fruit, nuts, meat. And when I did that, suddenly they're eating lots of vegetables because they were hungry.
Right. Well, if there's not too much else around, eventually
they'll eat.
But why not make it something that might be a little more appetizing to them?
Well, yeah, and when we figured to add, you know, the more fat and vinegar, so it wasn't bitter. Mm-hmm. Then it's like, wow, this is really yummy. And those bacon and kale, it's like, oh my God, that is really yummy.
Right. And then you feel so much better about what's going into your child's body.
Yeah.
Because, you know, like you said, in the books you've written, food really is medicine. And you know that you're helping your child make those choices, because if they make the choices, they're going to go get that ice cream cone. They're going to have the cookie. That's what they do.
And what many parents don't realize, it's very typical for a child to have the taste 30, maybe 40 times before they've accommodated, like, well, you know, actually Brussels sprouts are good. But, you know, it's okay. 30 times, it's okay. But, you know, it's a process. We have been convinced to use sugar mm-hmm. as a behavior control, and that was made a lot of profit for a lot of companies at the expense of our children's health.
Oh, I 100% agree. It is that challenge of, like you said, you can make the choice of what's coming in your home if you're paying for it, mm-hmm. but the children do go off. Just, I mean, I'm in the school system. I see what comes in, and, you know, so they can have it at school and they can have it at maybe a grandparent's house or a friend's house.
Correct. So you have to talk mm-hmm. Lots and all the time about the consequence, and they'll blow you off. And they'll hear it. They'll blow you off. They'll hear it, and eventually it will be assimilated. And it's a little different. Are you doing it for mom's health, dad's health, or the child's health? Yeah. And no, if you're doing it for mom's health or dad's health, the child shares those genes, and so they're now in the prodromal state. If you don't change their diet and lifestyle choices,
absolutely.
And they will develop those chronic diseases about a decade earlier than mom and dad had.
And that's where I think we see our declining health in some instances.
Children's, so absolutely.
It's happening early. And I see, like I said, I see that. I teach elementary and I see that in the school systems currently. And that's what I worry about for my own children because I know they don't eat the best. But you gave great examples, especially for those where it can be challenging. Just maybe your grocery budget is minimal that you can spend on. And you had great advice for that. So farmers markets, if it needs to be canned or whatever you can do that makes it manageable.
It makes it manageable. You know, but we certainly taught people how to do vegetarian cooking so they could have meatless options to maintain their protein intake. You can do this living on food stamps. But you will have to learn how to cook.
So, I mean, obviously environment, the culture which you grew up in, the food you intake, all play a part in our health. Do you have any hopes for our food system going forward in the future, or do you see it taking a positive turn?
Well, one can choose to be pessimistic, or one can choose to be optimistic.
I agree.
I think the internet accelerates the speed of change. And while we could be terribly pessimistic about the declining health statistics, we can also be optimistic that the public interest in organic foods is the fastest growing sector in the food industry. The organic produce is the fastest growing sector in agricultural industry as well. So I think because it's easier for the public to learn about the healing stories from their friends, families, and neighbors, I'm very optimistic that the public, we will teach one another that diet and lifestyle is how we become well. I'm optimistic because, you know, 10 years ago, I was the only researcher in the country doing dietary intervention studies for MS. Now, because I'm still doing research and publishing papers, and I was looking at the number of dietary intervention studies that are happening right now, funded at the on clinicaltrials.gov, and I believe there are 13. So that dramatic uptick in the number of dietary intervention studies for MS, and there are more health behavior studies for Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and MS, and health coaching. So we're finally doing the research. Clinicians are more aware. 10 years ago, I was being viewed as dangerous, causing potential harm by talking about diet and lifestyle. Now I'm being viewed as this brilliant visionary, almost national treasure, because I've been out there talking about this stuff and doing this research. And that's in just a 10-year time period. So while there's always reasons to be concerned, there's also reasons to be optimistic, and we all just need to do what we can to advocate for the health for our family, tell our neighbors, encourage family and friends to use diet and lifestyle to improve their health and keep going forward.
So just in the past 10 years, it's amazing to hear that maybe doctors have taken maybe this part more seriously, the diet and lifestyle.
Yes, absolutely.
And that, I think, just the view of future medicine for you, I think I can probably guess on this, but I'm assuming you hope it is getting it out there that there's so much we can do through.
And I think the public will be ahead of the physicians. I think the public is getting more and more interested in health coaching, diet, and lifestyle. I'm telling my colleagues here at the medical school that physicians will be replaced by the profession that addresses diet and lifestyle if we don't get on board. Mm-hmm. And there's certainly more young physicians that are very interested in the diet and lifestyle approach for medicine. So,
and that excites me, like I said, because it's been something that I've experienced, you've experienced it on a different level. So I'm, like I said, I'm very grateful and appreciative of your experience. Of course, I cannot imagine what you went through that, but what you have chose to do through your experiences has helped. It has really helped. Well, one, anyone with MS, if they've even looked into MS at all, they would have found you and listened to what you suggest. But you're really changing the view of medicine and lifestyle, because medicine's important. I will never discount that. I'm very grateful for doctors. I've used them many times for my children as well. However, there's so much we can do, and I love that you're getting that information out there. So for the listeners out there, do you have any final thoughts you want to leave them with?
Well, yeah. Please go to my website, terrywallace.com/diet. We have a one-page handout summary for the diet that will get you started. Put it on your refrigerator and begin your journey of reclaiming your health.
Oh, thank you so much for joining us tonight. I know I took away numerous things that I plan to implement. So thank you again for your time.
You're very welcome.
We'd like to remind our audience that the views of our guests do not necessarily reflect the views of Biteable or of our staff personally. The purpose of the Biteable podcast is to encourage spirited dialogue around topics like food, nutrition, animal and human welfare, and the food system. Part of having an open and spirited dialogue is accepting that others have views that are different than ours and working to understand how their experiences have differed from our own. We encourage all listeners to do their own research on any and all topics discussed during the show. That being said, we hope you enjoyed the podcast, and thanks for listening.